On ABC Radio,
this is The Big Fish
with Scott Levi.
It's The Big Fish, and as you know, there's not much that Peter Morse doesn't know about fly fishing, but he was given a lesson by our first cast this morning, Peachy, Steve Peach, and here's a little bit of Peachy and Morsey up to their proverbials in the river having a fish.
I've got my good mate Peter Morse here with me today. Pete's going to be my guinea pig for the day. A little bit of a role reversal. Pete's a master casting instructor and, you know, very accomplished fly angler and somebody I've learned a great deal from. But this is going to be your first time urine nymphing, mate.
Yes, it is. I've heard a lot about it. I've sneakily through the bushes watched people doing it.
Yeah.
But I have actually never thrown a fly with this style of casting.
Good morning, Peachy.
Good morning, Scott. How are you?
I'm very well. That must have been a bit nerve-wracking, teaching the master something new. And he said, he sounds like a bit of a perv. You know, I've snuck through the bushes and peeked at people doing it, you know, stripping the nymph. I've never had a go. That sounded a bit,
well, you know. Yes, I mean, I suppose you could say uro-nymphing is one of those styles that perhaps is a little controversial in some circles in fly fishing.
Yeah. Look, I know there are purists, the dry fly purists, who'll only fish a very dry fly and only drink a very dry martini, who would look down their noses at it. But, you know, whatever floats your boat, I mean, you're still using a fly rod, but you're not using fly line, really. What did you teach Morsey? Because this seems to be the missing link for a lot of nymph and dry fly fishers and wet fly and streamer fishers to fish parts of the river that they don't usually fish.
Yeah, that's right. Look, it's a technique that opens up different water types than you can cover perhaps with more traditional techniques. And it's a very different style, particularly the casting, I think, is the first thing that strikes most people. If somebody is used to traditional fly casting, where you're casting the mass of the line, you have a lot more control over where the fly is going to go. But of course, you don't have that mass in the fly line in uro-nymphing. You're actually literally just casting the weight of the nymph itself, a tiny little tungsten bead on a hook, and you've just got a very thin line down to that. So it makes casting a lot more challenging and requires a few different techniques to get it out there.
You can give yourself some new earrings, can't you? If you don't chuck and duck, what's the technique?
So, I mean, there's a few things. The first thing is something that also applies in traditional fly casting, which is called the 180-degree rule, which is that, you know, in normal casting with a spinning rod, say, you might put the lure or the sinker or whatever behind you and just cast out forwards. But of course, in fly casting, you're aerializing the line and the weight behind you. So the 180-degree rule is that wherever that weight is behind you when you make your forward cast, the fly is going to end up 180 degrees from that in front of you. And of course, with a fly line, when you've got mass in a fly line, that allows you to direct the fly a little more easily. But when you've just literally got a weight that's on the end of a tiny little bit of mono or tippet, you have very little control over where it's going to go with the motion of the rod.
And we're not talking about much weight, are we? A weighted nymph would be like a tiny, if you're trying to describe it to a bait fisher, if you're fishing for Ludric, for example, one of those tiny little split shot that you put on the end of the line, that there's no weight really to cast. You're still using different techniques to get it out there to the fish, aren't you?
Yeah, that's right. You are talking tiny weights. I mean, the smallest sort of beads that we use would be about 2 millimetres in diameter, and a really heavy bead would be 4 millimetres. So that's probably smaller than the size of a split shot. And of course, they're made out of tungsten rather than lead. And the reason for that, obviously, is for the additional weight. What we're wanting is the weight without the size so that it can cut down through the water and also look realistically like an aquatic nymph, a nymphal stage of an insect in the river.
I've tied a few up for mates, you know, to their recipe with an orange tail and a black fake seal's fur body. They don't use the real thing anymore, the artificial stuff, which is very good. Ribbing of copper wire, a flash back, a gold tungsten bead, and I've sent a few down to a mate to his recipe in Tassie, and he hooks them out. But he fishes places that I'm really keen to do it because you walk past a lot of these places. We fished a canoe racing, a whitewater canoe racing area up in the Derwent catchment, where the water was coming out of a sluice gate, out of a dam, at a million miles an hour. And I said, you can't fish in there. And he said, watch this. And because there's no fly line to catch the current, it just cuts straight through down to the bottom. And he's pulling these big fish out of this raging torrent of water. It's quite extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And look, that's one of the big advantages of this style of nymphing. It works on the principle that the surface current in a river is going to flow a lot faster than the current down on the bottom, where you have, rocks and various obstructions that are sort of slowing up the water currents on the bottom. So one of the challenges in conventional nymph fishing, if you're using an indicator or a dry fly, is that the speed of your nymph that you're hanging underneath in the water is tethered to the surface speed of the indicator or whatever's floating on the surface. So the idea with tight line nymphing or Euro nymphing is to cut right through those surface layers and not have anything that is tied to the surface current so that you can get your nymph down deeper and also fishing slower and with a better drift at a more natural pace for the current on the bottom of the river.
And that's where the fish are, isn't it?
Well, a lot of the time, particularly in that fast water, yes, it'd be very rare for a trout to hang up in the top currents in the fast water where they have to work hard. What they tend to do is find a little hydraulic cushion on the bottom of the river where they can sit and let the food come past them. And when they see something that comes close enough, they'll shoot out a little bit and take that. But depending on the speed and the depth, of course, they'll only travel so far because they have to take in more energy than they expend in feeding.
And if this little morsel that's at the whim of the current starts racing across the bottom in an unusual way, the fish know that a mayfly nymph or any sort of aquatic insect doesn't behave like that. They can't, you know, swim at the speed of light across the bottom, can they? And they just say, no, thank you. Any slight amount of drag puts them right off, usually, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right, usually. I mean, fish behaviour is very complex, obviously, and there are times, there are particular insects like caddis, for example, where the trout might expect a fly to be swinging across the current or swimming, but most of the nymphal life in a river, particularly mayflies, as you said, they don't swim. They come down in a very natural dead drift without moving very much. And if trout get keyed into that kind of feeding, and particularly if they're pressured fish that have been fished to quite a lot, they get very sensitive to any slight amount of unnatural drag.
It's the Big Fish, and with us fly fishing guru Peachy, who had Morsi on the river. And it's quite a contrast, isn't it? It shows you how versatile fly fishing is because Peter Morse has fallen in love with these giant double-handed spey casting rods that throw a line an incredible distance. They throw a weightless fly, 100 metres and more. It's extraordinary. Here we're fishing very close with only monofilament out of the rod tip usually, and maximum, I guess, 20 feet, better to be closer and hook the fish. So it shows you the versatility of this style of fishing, doesn't it?
It sure does, yeah. And look, close-range fishing, most of the time in fly fishing, is the most effective way to go. The closer you can get to the fish, the more accurate you're going to be, the more control you have, and the more likely you are to catch and land a fish and get a better drift. But having said that, you can fish out to a reasonable sort of distance with a tight line nymphing rig, you could fish out to perhaps 30 or 35 feet or maybe even 40 feet in really extreme cases. But most of the time, if you're wanting to fish the most effectively, you're actually trying to get closer to the fish and get a more controlled presentation and drift to them.
Still stalking, still stealthy, I guess, as well, but you've got the cover of that riffled and white water, that roily water at the top of the run, usually where the fish are, at the tail of the run, and using the water haul, or using the friction created by the flies going downstream, gives you that loading of the rod, does it? You can then fire it upstream a bit.
Yeah, very much so. Using a water haul cast is a really effective way, especially when you're getting started in this, because the casting, we definitely use aerialized casting sometimes, and even double hauling, which somebody who's familiar with conventional fly casting might know what that is. But particularly at the start, using a water haul is the simplest way to get going, where you simply use the current behind you, you place the fly about 180 degrees from where you want it to go and suspend it there in the top of the current, and then you just flick it forward. It's not necessarily a difficult technique to get started in, but once you get into the nuances, obviously there's a learning curve, and you can spend years sort of improving and getting better at it.
And I believe it came about similar to Italian cuisine in some ways, you know, limited ingredients. People have to think outside of the box, don't they? You think about just pasta and how wonderful the sauces are and the flavourings. Well, apparently some battling fly fishers who couldn't afford fly lines came up with this. It sounds apocryphal. Is this a true story?
Well, I wasn't there. I don't know the intimate details of what happened, but the story goes that back about 30 years ago at a World Championships, the Polish teams and the Czech teams, they couldn't afford fly lines, so the story goes. And so they were just using monofilament directly to the fly and casting very short and hanging nymphs under the rod tip and so on. And they went to the World Championships and they actually cleaned up and did really well and beat all the other teams and were well ahead for several years. And then, of course, all of the other teams started following suit and realising that actually this really short line, very close fishing approach had some definite advantages to it.
But you do some funny things to the fishing line, don't you? Because this is really using fishing line, not that thick fly line that loads the rod that most people associate with fly fishing, but you colour it up, I believe.
Yeah, that's right. So the line actually becomes your indicator. So normally if you were fishing, doing what we call indicator nymphing, you might have a bobber of some sort. It's almost like float fishing for Luderich in some ways. You'd have like a ball of fluff or a little foam thing called an indicator on your line that would float on the surface, and you would normally be watching for that to duck under the water. So what tightline nymphing does is it removes that indicator, and instead we colour up the line that sits above the water. We're suspending that line out of the water and we're watching the coloured line above the surface for it to stop or move unnaturally or tighten to indicate when we've had a take. And that's what we use to decide when we're going to strike and set the hook on a fish.
ABC Central Coast is the Big Fish, and we're speaking with Peachy all about tight line nymphing, or Czech nymphing as some people call it, or Euro nymphing. Depending on where you come from. If the Poles, I'm sure, call it Polish nymphing as well, because it was a technique that, as Peachy said, came out of Czechoslovakia and Poland, where they have some great trout streams. And will any old nymph do, or is it a case of recreating nymphs? Because the ones I tied for my friend, he wanted this orange tail and a flashback and the tungsten bead. I put some lead in some and you know, different weights. I mean, and you use those fibres that, like peacock hurl or, pheasant tail or whatever, that and some of the furs that wiggle in the water. I mean, is there a specific style of nymph?
Well, there are different styles of nymphs, for sure. I would say that the one sort of component that is absolutely critical in it is the tungsten bead. And it's because of the weight of the bead comparative to the size of the nymph. And in fact, There's a very interesting video that I've seen from a member of the New Zealand fly fishing team, a bloke called Ollie Bassett, where he literally tied just tungsten beads onto a hook with no other dressing whatsoever and went out and caught a bunch of fish on it. because I think the theory is that a lot of the time the fish eat the bead rather than the fly. So if you have a silver bead, for example, on the front of the hook, it can look like an air bubble that a nymph will form around its head in order to rise to the surface of the river.
Yeah, fascinating, fascinating stuff. And this tutorial online, it's beautifully filmed. The sound quality is great as well. You're really good at your YouTube production at Peachy Fly Fishing, and you were catching them left, right, and centre. And Peter Morse, who could catch them in a bucket, I don't think he caught any. I mean, that's tragic. That's tragic.
Well, to be fair, he only fished for a relatively short amount of time while we were filming the tutorial.
You didn't edit him catching out, did you? You didn't do that.
No.
No, you're a good bloke.
And look, I didn't catch that many that day either. I think I only caught a couple while we were filming.
Well, they were on film. They were on film. Yeah. It looks like the Coxes or somewhere, is it? I don't want to give away the secret spots.
It's another feeder river that feeds into Warragamba Dam.
Yes, right. Not the Coxes, but that other one.
Yeah.
If people are going to get their glass of water now to have their pills or put their teeth in, this is where the water comes from. So we've got to look after that water, haven't we?
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. It's a very interesting style of fishing. Obviously, you enjoy all forms of fly fishing. Did Peter give you a tuition on the thing that really has captured his imagination of late, the double-handed spey casting that came out of the giant salmon rivers of Scotland?
Yeah, absolutely. I have done some spey casting lessons with Peter, and that's been fantastic. I really enjoy the double-handed fishing. We have a few rivers here, a few of our larger rivers that suit that sort of spey casting style. Of course, we don't have the salmon or the really large fish, but certainly people will use spey casting outfits to fish for trout in some of our bigger tailwaters, for example. And I also quite like using a double-handed rod around Sydney Harbour just for general saltwater fishing, where we've got a lot of access to the foreshore, but not necessarily a lot of room to make a back cast with a conventional fly rod.
And Peachy, you came to fly fishing, you fell in love with the long wand at the age of 30. What were you doing then? Why did it take you so long to realise that this was your passion, your life?
Well, I sort of grew up near the water fishing, and I was always, I suppose I was a bit of a jetty rat as a kid. I was always out there, you know, with a line or even spearfishing and snorkeling around Sydney Harbour. And then I progressed into bait fishing and lure fishing once I got into my sort of teens and 20s. But I remember as a kid, I was down at my grandfather's place in Albury, and one of his friends brought over a little fly. It was a beautiful little dry fly. Thinking back, I think it must have been a purple humpy or something like that, or a royal humpy. Very beautiful, intricate, colourful little fly, and I was fascinated by it. And I thought, gosh, how do you catch fish on that? So I'd always sort of had this little bit of interest there in the back of my mind that, oh, one day I really want to try fly fishing. I'd really like to give that a go. And I didn't actually get to it until I was nearly 30. But after I bought my first fly rod and went out and cast it for a little bit, I pretty quickly decided that this was the style of fishing for me. I really loved the casting. I enjoyed the sort of the presentation and casting aspect of it. And I found that I could enjoy myself fly fishing regardless of whether I was catching fish or not, because just the act of sort of casting and mastering the technique was satisfaction in itself. So after that, I didn't really have an interest in picking up any other form of fishing again. It was just literally a transformation. I gave it a try and then decided that fly fishing is it for me.
Still a great attractor fly, the old humpy, isn't it? The royal humpy, yeah. Or the humpy of any style with the deer hair. Very innovative tie. I think it was credited to Jack Dennis. We've spoken to Jack Dennis on the show when he was out in Tasmania chasing our trout. A really terrific fellow, Jack. He wrote a beautiful book before the internet. he wrote Tying Western Trout Flies, and that was a book that taught me how to tie flies. It was a frame by frame, a really beautiful book. I don't know where I put it. I wish I still had it because it was just such a brilliant thing. And before the internet, you know, frame by frame, you'd work out how to whip finish and how to not crowd the eye of the hook. I mean, it's a terrific game within a game, isn't it, fly tying?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a whole rabbit hole in itself, isn't it? And look, it's quite interesting. You know, fly tying can be incredibly intricate and people can get very into the details of it. But if you look at the fly boxes of some of the top competition anglers around the world, they're probably, you know, only a fairly limited number of patterns and fairly sparse and perhaps fairly drab looking.
Yeah. Sparse and scruffy is good. And scruffy is good. Don't get too hung up on matching the hatch, you know. Make it, use those really mobile, materials. Cul de canard, isn't that just the best? The arse of the duck, I think, is the translation, isn't it?
That's right, yes, something like that.
It's the feathers from around the preen gland. If you've ever seen the ducks on the pond, you'll see that they dip their beak back towards their back end and move it around and then preen their feathers with the oily substance that comes out of that gland near their backside. And those feathers around that gland, they are just magical, aren't they, Peachy?
Absolutely. It's one of those wonder materials that just has beautiful movement and natural flotation. And I think the most attractive thing about it for dry fly tying is that it floats beautifully on the water, but when a fish comes up and eats the fly, the material is so soft that it just collapses around the hook, and the fish tends to find the hook really well. That's why I love CDC.
Yeah, very interesting. You can tie really small dry flies by using a little clump of it, and they don't have to look like anything, really, as long as they've got a bit of movement and a little bit of an upwing if it's supposed to be a mayfly or whatever. And getting back to this tight line nymphing, so you've got these little weighted nymphs, but you'd probably need to change a lot for different waters. Do you spend a lot of time changing flies? You know, how do you know that it's going to be down near the bottom in different depths and different speeds?
Yeah, so that's something that with a bit of experience, you'll be able to sort of at least get a good starting point. You'll be able to look at a bit of water and say, oh, okay, I think I need a 3mm bead for that. And you might have one or two flies. Sometimes we fish with two flies. But the other thing that we can use to determine whether our flies are getting to depth is by watching the sighter, the coloured line that we've got above the water. So when we first cast in, the flies are going to be sinking and the sighter will be moving at the same speed as the surface current. But when our flies get to depth, what we're looking for is for that sighter to slow down to indicate that the flies have reached depth and are now travelling at the speed of the currents near the bottom. So your indicator should be travelling at a slower pace than the surface currents. If you're watching, say, bubbles or something like that on the surface of the water, you'll see when your indicator starts to slow down and you'll go, okay, now I know my flies are down in the zone.
Well, that's the total opposite to indicator nymphing, isn't it, where it's dragging them along. It's fascinating. Yeah. You've been talking to some fly fishing clubs. I know you're heading up to talk to the crew at the Central Coast Fly Fishers soon. You had a talk on Thursday night at BWC Flies at Tuggerah, and you get around the Sydney clubs and all around the state. But it's wonderful that you're so captivated by this fishing and have such enthusiasm to pass it on to others. And fancy taking it up at 30. Amazing. And you've represented and that sort of thing, haven't you?
Represented. I'll be representing Australia for the first time next year in Norway at the World Masters Championships. So that's going to be a big step for me. I've never fished for grayling before, so there's going to be a bit of a learning curve there.
Wow, that's really exciting. We'll follow your journey. When I said you represented, you had to qualify for that, so you've got to go and fish some comps and things, you know, and show you that you're good enough to wear the green and gold.
That's right.
It's great to talk to you, Peachy. Thanks so much for joining us on The Big Fish. It's a fascinating game within a game, tight line nymphing. And if people want to know more about it, that's a great video on Peachy's YouTube channel with Peter Morse, Morsey and Peachy together. It's a very, very good starting point if you want to try this sort of fishing. And you can use your conventional gear although longer, thinner rods, longer, whippier rods are generally the go. Tight lines, mate, or tight loops, should I say. We'll see you on the stream.
Thanks, Scott.
There's Peachy, fly fishing guru.
On ABC Radio, it's The Big Fish with Scott Levi.
Here comes Stinker with his fishing tips. Some hot advice for your fishing trip. Where to find him? What's the bait?
Are you catching any, mate?
We're going to have to take up darts, I think, Stinker. Something indoors.
Oh, dear. There can't be much more rain left up there in the sky. It just got to dry up sooner or later, hasn't it? This is quite the most remarkable weather experience, as far as rain's concerned, that I could ever remember. It just doesn't seem to want to stop.
And it doesn't matter where you are, Port Stephens or your old stomping ground at Tweed Heads. You can't get away from it, can you?
No, you can't. From Sydney to Brisbane, and I've just come back from another week up on the Tweed, and it was very interesting because I visited by my grandson, and his mates come down from Brisbane, and they're in the house, and the rain's pelting down, and I can see them getting a bit edgy, you know, and they love fishing. There are four of them, and they love fishing. They're all 16 and 17 years old, and like that, there's not enough hours in the day when you're 17. And they said, oh, look, is there any chance we can go fishing? I said, well, have a look outside, and it's pouring rain. And they said, yeah, well, what's the problem? It's a bit damp. They said, oh, well, we got coats, you know, we got a hat, and, you know, it's all right. Don't worry about the rain. Have you got any bait? Oh, well, I did have. I had purchased the day before a kilo of prawns from the local down on the waterfront where the trawlers come in at Tweed Heads. Now, it's a different ball game up there because you can buy your prawns directly off the boat. They've been cooked on the boat. And you can buy them for $25 a kilo. That's incredible price for prawns, medium king prawns, fresh off the boat. Anyway, I'd had it in the fridge. I'd left the scraps, the heads and whatever else, the shell. And I said, oh, look, I've got a bit of, bits and pieces there that you could probably use for bait. And so anyway, I took all the heads, mainly the prawn heads. And then what you do, and I've done it before, you can pull the chest of the prawn with all his legs and then take off the carapace, which is the hard shell on the top. And then you gently put a hook around a number two, a 1-0 or a number two hook, unweighted, through the chest of the prawn head, and then gently cast it out and let it slowly, slowly sink. Well, these boys thought that this was great fun. Out they go in the pouring rain and the water's dripping off the mango tree and all, of course, the spots on the water and no one else is out. There's not another soul to be seen. But these guys are there and they've got their bits of bait on the... And, well, the first guy catches one, a brim. Like I said, there's more brim there you can pay the sticker. And it was a good brim, too. It wouldn't have been a kilo, but it was a jolly good brim. Well, that fires them up. They all get excited. And so they stand out there barefooted, and their all feet are going blue, and they don't care. And they just keep fishing, and then they start to lose a little enthusiasm. Then another bloke caught one. Holy dear, and they all start dancing around again. And they were out there for an hour and a half, nearly 2 hours in the pouring rain. They didn't care. And I thought, gee, it'd be nice to be like that again.
I love it. And you're right. You know, when you say medium-sized kings, they're so much nicer than the really big ones that can get a little tough, those smaller ones. Are they as good as Stockton Bite Prawn Stinker or Myall Lake prawns? I mean, those Stockton Bite prawns are beautiful too. They're just the right size. They're not tiny, but they're really tender and beautiful, aren't they? I guess there are a lot of trawlers used to go out of Port Stephens to chase those in the day down off Stockton Beach. Have you had a look at the progress of commercial fishing in that part of the world?
Yeah, well, I keep my eye on it very closely because I report weekly on recreational fishing. You can't avoid the commercial side of the game. And I know all the commercial fishermen, and we've got a very, very good relationship here in Port Stephens. I think I mentioned it before. And so, you know, we all talk and figure out how things are going. But the prawn industry here is all but gone. Oh, well, the trawler prawn industry is all but gone. The Myall River prawn is still going strong. And that started in 1920, and it's still going really strong. The amount of prawns that come out of the Myall Lakes is astounding. And the Myall prawn is a really beautiful prawn. It's a sweet prawn because it's sort of coming out of brackish water and not the really strong saltiness of the sea prawn. But the medium king that's coming off Stockton is a beautiful prawn. But the biggest problem is, and I go back to 1983, we had 23 working trawlers in Port Stephens. Today, we struggled to have two. And that's a reflection of quite a few things that have changed here. But, commercial fishing is a different game today than it was in years gone by.
That Myall system must be very productive and very sustainable, Stinker, if they've been doing the same thing, putting the nets out and checking. I've been up when they've been running. It's a terrific experience, isn't it, to sit on a boat and they row over, lift the pocket up, dump it into the bottom. And when we were there, they were putting them into a boiler on board and we were shoveling them out onto fresh bread. It was really a terrific experience with the water police, actually. I don't know whether it was legal. This was many, many years ago when I was a young boy, Stinker, so I don't know what... It was good fun, but, you know, obviously it's a very sustainable practice.
Well, obviously, because the reports and the returns are still very, very good. And there's a lot of commercial fishermen in it. And they have the draw once a month over at Tea Gardens, and it's like a raffle. And the raffle determines where on the Myall River the commercial fishermen can set their nets. And that was organised in 1920 by Vapos, a fisherman called Vapos. And he, because the fishermen used to argue about where they were going to put their nets, he said, well, I'll fix that. We'll have a raffle. And they've been doing the raffle since then. and no one complains. But that's a great thing. But I was also digging into the history of commercial fishing in Port Stephens, and it went way, way back. And there was a royal commission held here in Port Stephens, in Nelson Bay, the Seabreeze Hotel, which is still there, in 1894, on the 20th of November. And they were... The Royal Commission was to get better regulations on the fishing industry. So we go back a long way, Scott.
Amazing. It's the Big Fish with John Stinker Clark. And obviously we've got to talk about fishing because it's been raining so much. I saw an old bloke with a long white beard preparing a giant wooden boat the other day down the road. And was there boat building to support the local fleet as well, Stinker, or did they come from Brisbane Water or Sydney or other places?
Oh, no. They were all boat builders here. Fishermen were boat builders. They never rarely bought boats from other people. They would build their own. Now, they had no qualifications or training, but they were so clever. And they built these most beautiful boats. And there's one in the harbour at the moment called Pop's Last. Now, Pop's Last was built back in the 1940s and by a fellow, Sam Thompson, up into the swampland, up around the mangroves. And it's still in the harbour today. And a beautiful boat a better boat you would never see. So they were all good boat builders, the fishermen. But there was an article I saw in the Sydney Morning Herald in my research, and it went back to 1913. And they found Port Stephens and they thought, what a seafood gold mine this is. But the problem was, although we could supply everything and anything in any amount, that we needed ice. And there was no ice available, so there was no industry that could progress until ice became available. So there's a lot of things of great interest. And I go back to look at how it was probably in the mid-1800s with the Aboriginal people, of course, and they caught seafood to survive. But the Europeans, they caught seafood to barter. They used it for a barter system. So if they wanted something else, fruit or veggies or whatever else, they could barter with seafood and oysters. That was another one. But, I find it fascinating. I really do. And I always keep a very close eye on commercial fishing. And we talk regularly about, how accessible fish are, particularly mulloway, because mulloway have been under a bit of strain of late. But interesting to know that the mulloway stocks in Port Stephens are excellent. So I don't know where fisheries get the results to say that mulloway are under pressure, because our stocks are excellent here in Port Stephens. So, look, it's a big game, Scott. Fishing is a big, big game.
It is. That history is amazing too. I'm just looking at an image of Pop's Last online here, built in 1948, as you say, a 45-foot-long, 36-ton timber vessel. And it looks like it was built yesterday. Stinker, there was a story online about getting a new motor back in 2021, I think it was, and a new diesel motor to keep it going. And it's pristine, mate. I mean, they knew how to build a boat back in 1948.
Oh, these are beautiful boats. I know the captain of the boat. He only just lives down the road from me, and he's probably the last of the old fishermen that really used the old families. Right, the old families are pretty much dying out. The old fishing families are dying out for all sorts of reasons. And one is that it was always the expectation that the boys in the family would simply follow the father into the game and then become fishers as well. Well, a lot of them found that they could go to university and earn a lot more money with a lot less effort.
It's hard and dangerous and really physically tough. And, going out to sea and getting pounded by a big swell and having to go out in whatever condition, I mean, it's not for the faint-hearted. They're tough. They're tough people, Stinker.
Oh, and so are the women. The women, I interviewed many, many women, and they all were such dignified and strong, and because it was up to the women to run the household. And the men lived hard, and they were big drinkers too. They could drink the place dry. And they get into all sorts of strife, the fishermen. Not so much oyster men, but fishermen were real rascals back in those days. Not so much now. But so the women were equally as tough, and because they had to get the kids to school with a meagre income, they had to feed the family. Oh, look, it's interested me greatly. And there's another boat built around about the same time called the Dawn. And now the Dawn was built by Thompson as well. And that was a beautiful boat. And it went off to war and spent the war years up around Port Moresby, up in the waterways up around Port Moresby. And then it come back. They took the guns off it, and it started trawling again. But unfortunately, it was sold, and later it sunk. But, I'm into all this sort of stuff. I find the whole game very, very fascinating, and it's been a major part of my life. So, and you look at game fishing and fly fishing and catch and release and all this sort of stuff. Well, I never knew anything about that because I'm really just a kitchen fisherman. That's what I am.
Well, you were probably not only taught the children of commercial fishers, but probably the kids of game charter boat fishermen and people that in that industry too.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I taught thousands of them over the years. And I'll tell you what, the kids at Nelson Bay, and I started teaching here in 1975. I've been out of the game for quite a while now, but my experiences here, particularly early in my experiences, are the most wonderful kids you'd ever come across, because they were very capable and keen kids. And, oh, look, there were a few rascals amongst them, but then I think I might have been one myself, so I can understand all that. I remember when I was at school and I was wagged one day or a couple of days, and I'd be in my boat and I'd row underneath the Boyd's Bay Bridge at around about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, because all the teachers would drive from the school over the bridge to get home, and I didn't want them to see me.
So what, you'd hide under the bridge?
Get under the bridge, yeah, they wouldn't catch me there. So you can understand rascally kids, but they were good kids, very, very good kids. And now, of course, they're members of the community here in Port Stephens, and upstanding citizens. So, and it's great to see them I see them regularly.
And another big industry on the water, of course, these days, with tens of thousands of humpback whales migrating, are the tourist boats, aren't they? The Moonshadow and others, they're beautiful boats. Yep. I know you do your history tours and that. So that's a transition industry, I guess. There'd be people, you know, working in that industry now.
Oh, most certainly. It's a big growth industry here in Port Stephens. Tourism is a growth industry in Port Stephens because it's such a beautiful place. I'm not over it yet. I get up on a decent day. I haven't seen the sun for a while, but when I assume it's still there. But then when I see it next and we have a sunrise and it comes up behind the islands here, I think, wow, I could be in any part of the world. But I'm at home in my lounge room. And I'm thinking, how good's this? But whales, oh, they're a bit of a nuisance to me, because there was over 40,000 went through last year, and there'll be more this year, I'm sure. And they're so inquisitive. They're sticky beaks, and they want to come and look inside your boat. Well, I don't want them looking inside Stinkpot. They can stay a bit far away. But I'll be out on the water as soon as I can.
Well, the sun's coming out next week, Stinker, believe it or not.
Oh, you sure about that?
Well, I'm not positive, but they reckon we might get some sunshine next week. But, yeah, I've been anchored up near Cod Rock with you when they come right over and look in the boat virtually. You don't want to get close to them, but they seem to like you, Stinker. I don't know why. They seem to want to come over and check you out. I think they go up to the Barrier Reef. So you see that funny bloke out of Fingal, that bearded, bedraggled-looking fella in the little tiny boat with a or maybe it's the eye on the boat too, the eye on Stinkpot. You know,
could be too. I never thought of that because I've painted eyes on my boat, and they might think it's one of their relatives. That's right.
Yeah. That's right. Actually, that could be it because they do really check you out. It's a bit scary.
I'll put a patch over the eye. But I did go down to the breakwall in the rain with an umbrella, and you won't believe it. There were three or four, and they looked like they'd been washed in by high tide. They were fishing off the rocks for Ludric
fishes, yeah.
This is Ludric season. And normally you could go down there on the weekends and see 50. Sometimes I counted 70 people. This is when conditions were good. I went from one end of the breakwall to the other, and I counted 70 people fishing off the rock there. And most of them, their rods were buckled over, pulling in ludric. And that's what should be happening now. But all you see now, they look like just wet as shags, water dripping off the end of their nose, and they're stuck on the rock, and they're happy. Well, I assume they're happy. But, oh, dear. So when things settle down a bit, I'm expecting really, really good things to happen.
Oh, well, those boys had a bit of fun under the mango tree and caught a couple of nice brim, so it's terrific. Oh, we've got cabin fever for sure, Stinker. I'm sick of it. I really am itching as well. Tight lines, mate.
There is, Scott.
It's the big fish, and it's been pretty desperate right up and down the coast. The mid-north coast has been flooded again, everywhere from the Illawarra to the Tweed. It isn't good, but one place you can go is at the friendly local tackle shop. And if you're in Port Macquarie, head in and see Treno behind the counter and tell him you want to buy beach worms. He loves it. Go and ask him for beach worms. Why are people asking you for beach worms all the time, Treno?
People so unkind, mate. It's been raining. We've had 600,000 mil of rain. The sun comes out for half an hour. They want to know if I've got live beach worms. Please.
Excuse me, Treno, have you got worms?
Oh, not personally, but I got some in the bucket.
So it's a bit hard to get beach worms when we've had 200 mils of rain, isn't it?
And 4 metre seas, mate. Yeah, it does get a little bit. Look, I look. No disrespect, to people. I don't think they just look out their window and go, "Oh, that looks a bit horrid." I might not ask that question. But people being people, mate, it's all good.
Well, we know they're great bait. I mean, they're really, really great bait, particularly for whiting off the beach and in the summertime, and they'll catch mulloway as well. But and bream and they'll catch everything, won't they? But you don't need them at this time of year. Surely you could use anything else to catch. I don't know. I guess floodwater mulloway might be one of the target species. You'll still get your drummer and your blackfish around the rocks and things, won't you, with a bit of kelp or cabbage or weed?
Oh, mate, I can't wait for about Monday, Tuesday next this week coming, mate. I'll be snappering off the rocks this time, mate. There'll be some lovely fish around after this bit of a blow.
And why is that for the uninitiated? And if you don't know, don't go when it comes to rock fishing, most
that is
dangerous
exactly right, yeah.
Sport in Australia. But why do these conditions suit catching snapper off the stones?
Well, with the big seas that we've had, it'll knock all, if there was any left, any crabs and little bits and pieces, it stirs up the water and they come into the shallow water looking for a feed, that is. You know, might knock an abalone off the rocks, or it'd be a lobster might get smashed up. So they're in just having a look around and see what they can find, especially with the coinciding with the high tide like we have now early in the mornings. I reckon that I would be, as long as the sea's not too big. I don't like it over a metre or over a metre and a half. 2 metres is probably about the top of it, but actually, the flatter the day, the better. If there's no swell at all, I reckon those really smooth, flat days are the best ones you can find.
The water having a bit of murk to it, because they're a very shy fish, aren't they? Do they feel a bit more comfortable with that?
Yeah, you know, you start burling just before daylight, and not too hard, and then the burly gets them, and they're a little bit less likely to shy off. They'll come up into your burly trail, and they'll actually feed.
And what do you like for bait when you're doing that?
I'm a bit of a fan of a big prawn, mate. I don't mind.
Yeah, now, listeners of The Big Fish go mad when we talk about prawns. We're talking about wild-caught prawns that come from the waters where you're fishing. We're not talking about cooked prawns or Vanamai cooked prawns or imported prawns that could carry disease. And I guess a lot of people initially, when they were importing these prawns anyway, said, well, why are you importing prawns with the possibility of disease? But listeners are very attuned to that. They don't want people buying imported prawns or farmed prawns and using them in the ocean.
No, well, that's right, mate, because at White Spot, that's where it came from when we started importing prawns. I don't know why in Australia we had to import a prawn that is lower in quality than what we get here. But anyway, that's another story for another day. But I go and buy, whether they're the blue yellowtail king prawns, if they're nice and cheap. When I say cheap, they're down around that $20 a kilo. Or you get the big Queensland banana prawns. Mate, they're just as good. And I use a whole prawn on a 3-hour hook. Very little in weight. Probably I start off with a bobby cork in the morning so I can just see it, like a pure white one. And when I'm using prawn, I'm fishing. When I'm burlying for snapper, I like a lot more bread in my burly than I do pellets. If I'm fishing drummer, it's the other way around.
And how deep would you fish that prawn under the little white bobby cork, which looks like a speck of foam on the surface? It doesn't stand out too much, does it?
No, that's right. And what it does, I probably fished out a rod, which is usually about between 9 and 12 feet with no lead. I try not to use any lead at all, so I cast out and I just sit there and let it feed out, as you do, in a bit of wash or something like that. If it's a bigger sea, like if it's around a metre and a half to 2 metres, it's still punching in a little bit. So I'll use about a 4-ball down to my hook, and I'll have a slightly sturdier float to keep that up. But same principles, yeah.
Oh, well, good luck with it, Treno. It's great that you've got a plan, that you can see the light at the end of the tunnel, that you can see the day when the rain will stop on the Mid-North Coast, and you've got some plans. We'll catch up with you down the track and see if your snapper ideas work.
Well, let's hope so, mate. Otherwise, I won't have fish this week.
All right. Tight lines, buddy.
No worries. Thanks, mate.
The Big Fish with Scott Levi on ABC Radio.
Oh, get out of it, bloody seagulls.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.